Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 4:09 PM, and that is Pacific. Well, no, it isn't. It is Central Time, and today is June 7th. Well, looking at Biogen today, they've had obviously good news. The share was up in a dynamic manner. Didn't quite hold all of the gain, but certainly most of it, and it was on the back of their Alzheimer's drug being approved for sale. Now, there's still a lot of debate about whether it's really works or not, or the degree to which it works. And certainly the manner in which they have been going through the trial process opens up a lot of questions. But the bigger point is that this is going to be $56,000 a year. And when doctors are presented with a chronic disorder that will eventually lead to death, then they're probably going to, or at least a substantial proportion of those doctors are going to basically say that something is better than nothing. And it represents a significant money spinner, because it's the only drug available in the world for one of the most debilitating diseases, but also one of the fastest growth markets for any kind of chronic condition. The only other major chronic condition where there is no real effective treatment, at least that I can think of, is arthritis. And I'm sure that genetics labs around the world are working on that conundrum as well. Of course, this is a big company, so it also had a beneficial effect on the biotech ETF, which has bounced from the region of the trend mean. I sold out of my initial investment in the biotech ETF for a simple reason. I'm worried about the challenges that anti-free market governments are going to impose upon intellectual property. I don't really have any doubt about the potential upside or the potential innovation that biotech companies can come up with, but rather it's their ability to then pass on the costs to consumers and to healthcare organizations that will obviously be questioned. So one of the reasons why the Dow Jones was in negative territory today was because health insurers were leading on the downside, and United Healthcare is the largest constituent on the Dow. Well, they're the ones who are going to have to pick up the price, or they pick up the bill for this Alzheimer's drug, and there will be a substantial number of people who they will be responsible for. But in the wider market, we also had this significant move in the Peruvian sol, and it broke lower in here today and did so in a dynamic manner, and it has been depreciating for most of the last year. Well, the output of results from the election is pretty close to even, and I think it is looking increasingly likely that the left-wing candidate will win, but he is going to do so by the slimmest of margins. He's going to rule over a divided country, and his power to then impose a very left-wing agenda is impaired. So when we then think about the stock market index there, well, it's been trending downwards. In fact, sorry, this is the old ticker. I do apologize. When we then, golly, I'm going to have to learn this one off. It's a much longer one. But we can see there that the stock market has pulled back, and it's been rallying for the last year. It's been going sideways for about 3 years. When we then think about the outlook for Peru, well, what I found particularly interesting was Hochschild Mining didn't really move at all today. And it was down a bit, but certainly not in as dynamic a manner as the currency was. This is a much bigger play on silver. And if silver can break on the upside, and I think that it's a reasonable prospect that we could see silver breaking on the upside in the near term. It's been consolidating in an inert manner here for the last 4 weeks, and it's the upper side of the range. $30 has been an area of resistance over the course of the last year, and we can continue to see it finding support in the region of the trend mean. Gold prices were off their lows for the close in here today and finished in positive territory. This continues to look like a bounce from the region of the trend mean, and perhaps more importantly than that, what we saw back in November and January were big downward dynamics from this area. And this was a reasonably sized downward dynamic 3 days ago, and we've since recouped most of it. So far, it's a reasonably sized consolidation compared to those that we've already seen since the low put in back in early April. And this looks like a recovery scenario overall. Well, it's virtually just inconceivable that gold will go up without taking silver with it. And then we can think about the other precious metals, because platinum is also firming from the lower side of its range, and this continues to look like a recovery scenario overall and a first step above the base, to be more accurate. Now, we have had some weakness coming through in copper. So, copper prices have been largely going sideways now for most of the last month. It was a tad firmer in here today, but when we look at this longer term chart, this doesn't really look like anything other than a consolidation in the region of the all-time peak. And so far, this consolidation that's been going on now for the last month has been relatively similar sized to the previous one. So it's an extraordinarily steep advance, but at the same time, it's still consistent. And then when we can pull the chart history, we can see clearly that we're right in the region of the peak from all the way back in 2011, and it's obvious that there's going to be some reticence around this area. Every time we've got up to around these highs, we've had these very large downward dynamics, and they've capped the advance overall. So this is a very interesting area, but I think it's quite likely that we're going to see a significant break on the upside. There are a large number of tailwinds that are supporting the copper price. So, as we look at these long-term consolidations in the commodity complex and the emerging secular growth themes, we're getting exactly the same kind of cyclical versus secular bull market terminology and arguments being leveled. So, for those who are thinking about cyclical bull markets, they're thinking, well, we had extremely depressed levels in 2020, we've had a significant rebound, and that's all it is. That we've had a big pullback, we're getting a big snapback, simple that it was an artificially induced major contraction because of the lockdowns, and subsequently we've had an artificially induced major rebound, and that as soon as there are even modest efforts to normalize policy, it's all going to come crashing back down again. So that would be the cyclical bull market hypothesis. And I think the people that are primarily making that argument are Morgan Stanley. What they've been very clear about is they believe that this is going to be a short cycle. So that's quite bearish, because they think that this economic cycle is powerful on the upside at the beginning, but it's going to run out of fuel early, and that we're subsequently going to see our next recession in the not so distant future, perhaps in the next couple of years, rather than the next 5 or 6 years. So that's certainly one argument. Now let's look at the other side of the argument, that this is more of a secular bull market. That yes, we had this extraordinary pullback, and now we've had this extraordinary rebound. And this extraordinary rebound is predicated not only on the snapback from an artificial decline, but also that we have this newfound will to reshape the global economy. And in order to do that, it's going to require waves of additional liquidity, and that there is a new found resolve to remake the economy on a carbon neutral environment, and that it is going to require gargantuan spending in terms of energy infrastructure. So when we then think about the uptrend that we see, for example, in Fortescue Metals, it's still consistent and it's still tracking the iron ore price. So when we look, for example, at the Singapore iron ore future, then it's really quite comparable that we had the big pop on the upside, we've had the consolidation, and now it's rebounded, and that's exactly what Fortescue has done. So it is still, and I think justifiably still, being priced as if it's an iron ore company, which of course it is. But they're spending a ton of money on developing green hydrogen resources in Western Australia and primarily the Pilbara. So then the question is, how long will it continue to trade like an iron ore company? Well, it's just an example of one company that is voluntarily deploying assets into a new sector. Then, of course, you have involuntary deployment of assets. On the one hand, we've had the car companies. They didn't want to adopt electric vehicles. They're being forced to. And the success of Tesla has been the primary motivation, because they were effectively having to fund Tesla's expansion through having to purchase carbon credits via the carbon trading system in the USA. And then, of course, Tesla opened a factory, or is, well, not opened, but is building a factory in Germany. They want to try and get the German automotive companies to pay for their expansion into Europe. Well, obviously, then companies like Volkswagen said, well, we're not going to let that happen. So they've belatedly adopted an electric vehicle mandate. It's been rewarded by the stock market, and the share has clearly rebounded from the 200 euro level, and it continues to rebound. As soon as Ford announced that they're going to start selling an electric F-150, the share price has now clearly broken the downtrend and is now right back in the region of the peak from back in 2014. This is not just about a snapback from the underlying economic malaise of 2020, but rather that this is renewed enthusiasm for what is effectively a value company. And the PE is now up to about 15, but it wasn't 15 a year ago. And before the pandemic, it was trading in single digits. So we're definitely seeing much more investment and faith being, I think, or at least investors having faith that these companies can evolve and that they will eventually be in a position to challenge the new interlopers like Tesla, which has pulled back as a result of this rebound that we've seen in the conventional companies. So now it's the turn of the oil companies. They're being forced to adapt. Now, companies like Royal Dutch Shell had been further along than others because they primarily concentrated on gas. So the share has rebounded from the lows we saw in 2020, but it's not capitalizing on that advance because, primarily because I think it's a European energy company, and it is Europe that is a major energy importer and therefore has got a clear incentive to try and penalize the energy companies in order to try and drive a move into alternatives. There is a clear geopolitical imperative as well as a cost imperative, because the USA is now energy independent in practical terms. So therefore, when everybody was an energy importer, whether that was Japan or China or Europe or really the USA, then it wasn't a point of competition. But now that the USA is energy independent, it puts much more pressure on everywhere else to develop their own unique energy policy. So Europe's policy has been to really to adopt a renewable energy mantra. China is going down a multifaceted route, and they don't just want to be a producer of energy. They want to export energy making equipment to the rest of the world, which has been responsible for their massive investment in solar and their subsequent massive investment in battery manufacturing capacity and buying up the resources as well to ensure that they can continue to supply their own batteries for an electric future. Of course, none of this has anything to do with the carbon emissions that these companies are responsible for. It's certainly being used as a rationale to impose these kinds of taxes. And there is absolutely no doubt that governments need additional sources of tax revenue. So they are certainly looking for ways to tax. And then, of course, you have public opinion, which definitely is not going to tolerate personal income taxes and corporations that don't really want to pay additional corporate taxes. So they're imposing carbon taxes, which are by definition local and can be imposed upon companies quite easily. And those companies can be vilified in the press so that they will have less recourse to support from public opinion if they run into trouble, which is exactly what we have right now. So when we think then about the cyclical versus secular bull market hypothesis, well, it's not so difficult to come up with a secular bull market hypothesis. And then we have the additional point that large numbers of indices around the world are breaking out. So the Italian stock market broke out to new highs for the decade over this are in here today. So this is a new recovery high. The MIB hasn't traded at this level since 2008. And then we can think about European banks, which have also been out on the hinterland of investing for quite some time. The index is up 100% in the last year. It's now right in the region of the peaks from early 2020 and into 2019, and this is pushing up into the overhead trading range overall. So now we can certainly think about this as a recovery candidate. We've already seen a significant rebound in the US financial sector. Now, there is obviously something that is also worth considering, that banks are doing very well. Banks are liquidity providers. So they are going to be looking for opportunities to invest. There has been a lot of commentary about how active the Federal Reserve has been in the repo market. And there's, of course, a good reason for that, because they have been forced into the repo market. The Fed isn't happy or isn't voluntarily intervening in the repo market, but they don't have a lot of choice because banks are awash in deposits and they're pushing up against their limits. So they have to provide a market for those deposits to go find a home. What, of course, means is that banks will be willing to lend, and at the moment, lending standards are still rather tight. But the way that bull markets evolve, now we are well away from 2008, and we're well away from the onerous regulation that was imposed on the banking sector. And that onerous regulation on the banking sector had a profound change on their balance sheets. So the US market for financials was pretty much completely recapitalized. That did not happen in the EU. But nonetheless, if the dollar goes down, inward investment will start to creep back into Europe. That inward investment will start to support asset prices. Asset prices rising will help to support the banking sector balance sheets, and they'll be more willing to lend as a result. So the linchpin of the secular bull market hypothesis for the rest of the world is going to be very much tied to the decline of the dollar on a secular basis. And That is the big question that's outstanding. Every time it comes back down to these lows that have been forming over the last 6 months, it's bounced. So it bounced on Thursday, and over Friday and today, it has been pulling back. If the dollar breaks downwards, then it's going to be a significant tailwind for the commodity complex. It'll be also a significant tailwind for capital flows out into the higher growth markets. So the Asia dollar index has been pausing here in the region of the January peak. It's on the cusp of breaking on the upside. This looks like nothing more than a consolidation, and it is looking quite likely that this period of inaction since 2015 is about to be resolved on the upside. Now, when we look at the long-term history of the Asia dollar index, it took an enormous dive during the Asian financial crisis. It recouped a lot of that decline up to the peak in 2011, and it has been deteriorating for a decade. So, if it can break this downtrend, well, then that is going to be a green light for investment into the Asian region. And when we look at the respective stock markets, even those that have been underperforming so far this year are increasingly demonstrating evidence of support coming back in. Then we can think about the outperformers like India, and that has also continued to push on to new high ground. And then Vietnam, which is roundly regarded as the big beneficiary from the pandemic. It was a little softer in here today, but this has been a very impressive breakout. The Mexican market was also in positive territory today. I think that is also particularly relevant. When we look at just how much the Mexican market has rallied in the last year, and it has unwound a 3-year downtrend in the space of really only about 9 months. So this is a very impressive advance overall. Then we can think about this in currency adjusted terms, and it is just now breaking what's effectively an 8-year downtrend. So it's looking increasingly likely that we're going to see emerging markets going back on the front foot and having clear potential to outperform on in nominal terms, but also more importantly in currency adjusted terms. And again, the big argument will be about whether the dollar does in fact break lower, which I think is looking progressively more likely. I remember teaching the chart seminar back in 2007 or 8 in Sydney, and I remember one of the delegates saying, "Why would we want to look abroad when the currency is so strong?" And then, of course, the other side of that argument is, why would anybody want to invest domestically in a weak currency environment when they can pick up the stronger currency and the stronger capital appreciation in markets where there is that growth and inward investment? So the ASX is continuing to hold this breakout to new highs. And I think it's likely that this is going to continue for as long as we continue to see commodity prices going upwards. And then the New Zealand index has also firmed again from the region of the trend mean, and this has been a very orderly consolidation in the region of the previous peak. But it's also worth looking at that in US dollar terms, just on a for a currency adjusted basis, and we can then clearly see how much higher this consolidation is above the peak put in early 2020. So the appreciation of the currency is certainly helping these currency adjusted returns, and it means that these kinds of markets are going to become progressively more attractive. So that also supports the commodity-led bull market, And then the emerging markets bull market, the outperformance of banks. So it's extremely similar to what we saw in the early 2000s. And if that's the case, then we can anticipate that the champions of the pandemic, the companies that did best, they're going to have a hard time repeating that performance. Amazon, for example, is being singled out for taxation. Their margins are less than 10%, and that's particularly true on their online marketplace. But they will fall under that international tax agreement that was agreed by the G7. The bigger you are, the bigger a target you become. And this is particularly true for these large companies with vast cash piles. And we can anticipate that policy will be tailored to ensure that these extremely large and successful companies are penalized so that broke governments can find an additional revenue source without having to raise taxes on individuals. Of course, since Amazon is a low margin business overall and invests everything in trying to introduce shorter and shorter delivery timescales. I bought a new faucet for our kitchen. Well, I didn't. Mrs. Tracy bought a new faucet for our kitchen last night, and it was here at 4 a.m. this morning. Now, why they're delivering at 4 a.m. in the morning is another question entirely. But the reality is that Amazon is constantly investing in their business. If they are going to be taxed into a non-profitable position, well, they're going to raise their prices. And if they raise their prices, well, then that is directly inflationary. So the one thing that looks likely is we're going to have an inflationary outcome. And 10-year Treasury yields have been ranging around the 1.5% level for most of this last 3 months. I have some sympathy with the potential for a full reversion to the mean. So far, that has been delivered just by simply going sideways and allowing the moving average to catch up. The important point here is that it's holding the 1.5% level, and that's the lower side of the trading range that evolved from about 2011 through to 2020. And if it continues to hold the region of the trend mean, it's still an uptrend. And that would suggest that the potential is we're going to have more of an inflationary outcome. And as long as inflation doesn't accelerate higher, well, then that should also be beneficial for emerging markets. Because we have to remember that the USA and the Federal Reserve want inflation. And they're not really willing to do much to ensure that it does not take off. In fact, they're doing everything possible to ensure that it trends higher. And in between now and when they, in fact, do begin to withdraw that liquidity, there's still potential for asset prices to appreciate, but internationally, probably more than domestically. Of course, there are high growth portions of the market, and the Russell 2000 continues to outperform. And there is nobody out there actively targeting the profits of small companies. It's the extremely large companies that are at the greatest risk from spot checks and from just a clear intention to try and carve their pound of flesh from these companies. So the cloud sector is also still steady. The challenge for the cloud sector is not so much that there's a problem with the individual constituents, but rather that the largest companies in the world are all cloud companies. So, to one extent or another, then they will have an outsized effect on the outlook for the entire sector. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.